You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to episode 50 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or visit our website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all, here we are at episode 50, and I want to give a huge thank you to everyone who's subscribed and tuned into the podcast over the past year and a half. I've had a blast doing it, and I've got a lot of great material coming your way. Apropos, today's interview is with Ramiz Tayz. He is the Vice President of Audience Development and Insights at Axios. They are a digital media outlet that focuses on business, technology, and politics, but they present content in a way that's very social media friendly. It's very short form, but still very informative. And within the media industry, there's been a lot of frustration around platforms like Facebook and Google, who together take up over half of all digital ad spending in the United States, and then across the globe, take up over one quarter of all advertising. And these platforms are basically intermediaries between publishers and their audience, and they have the power to shape the content and the distribution of news. So many in the industry consider Facebook and Google to be a duopoly in influencing news publishing. And if you want to know what the tech industry feels about that, go ahead and step back to the previous episode of this podcast. But I was curious to find out more about how a digitally native news outlet like Axios is crafting a business model to meet the digital age and to meet the power of platforms like Facebook and Google. So Ramiz and I, we discuss some of the challenges that publishers are facing with the rise of tech platforms. We discuss some of the opportunities that being a digitally native news outlet can have, not having that broadcast era thinking. We talk about what metrics and data are important for publishers in terms of reaching their audience. And overall, I think it's a really fascinating interview that gives an insight into how publishers are thinking about crafting content and crafting really a core audience of loyal supporters that can perhaps override some of that intermediary power that Facebook and Google has. So without further ado, let me cut to the interview. Again, my guest is Ramiz Tayz. He's Vice President of Audience Development and Insights at Axios. I hope you enjoy it.
Ramiz, thanks so much for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Yeah, thank you for being here. I've listened to a couple of episodes, as I mentioned last weekend, and I was loving it.
Excellent. And you have the distinct honor of being the 50th guest.
Wow, what an honor.
So before we get into the ins and outs of digital news publishing, which is what I want to ask you about, why don't we start out and set the stage and talk a little bit about Axios? Can you give us a brief overview of the company? What are its missions and the main sectors that it covers?
Yeah, so Axios is a new media company. We're about a year and a half old. And our mission is really to make people smarter, faster on the topics that we think matter. And those topics are really the collision of technology, business, and politics. Mm-hmm. Apply to a variety of sectors. And so we do cover traditional verticals like politics or like healthcare. But what we found really, really differentiates us is looking at all of those verticals through that collision of those three subjects, because you can't separate them in today's day and age.
Yeah. So instead of looking at just news or just politics or just tech, it's sort of looking at the intersection between them.
Absolutely.
Interesting. So what I wanted to ask you about is, so we're here in the Axios offices, which are amazing.
Brand new
on the 13th floor, very Scandinavian feel too.
You can see the Washington Monument.
Yeah, it's super cool and gives me kind of a feeling of almost like a tech company news publisher, which I think is fitting because Axios is a digitally native news outlet. And what I wanted to ask you about is, that's different from some of these broadcast era networks like CNN, Fox, MSNBC. And I suppose on the one hand, that creates some challenges, but also some opportunities. So could you discuss those trade-offs in terms of being a startup publisher compared to being a more established network?
Yeah, so I'll start with the benefits that maybe legacy media has, the tailwinds. And I think really there are incentives for those big companies to do things with a more long-term oriented hat on. And even when they don't make the right decision, there's a lot more leeway and opportunity for failing up, so to speak. And so a couple more specific examples. There's a ton of brand leverage. So there's a new platform, it seems, almost every week where the so-called millennials are gravitating towards, whether that's Snapchat or Facebook Watch or the next platform. And what's the first thing you do as a news consumer when you get one of those platforms? You look for CNN or you look for the New York Times. And so even if it's not the right move strategically, those platforms will kind of skew successful towards legacy media. Mm. And connected with that, there's not infinite, but close to infinite resources to actually build those things. I think at the heyday of Snapchat Discover, there were several digital media companies that were employing upwards of 15 people to produce just that show. And because it's shot in a vertical video and very exclusive to Snapchat, there's no other synergy for those people. Legacy media companies can afford to shoulder that burden a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And lastly, there's still a lot of this cross-collateralization of revenue streams. So you can have a new property where you're going to take a very long view towards monetization, or you can actually even view it as a loss leader or a brand builder. And so having that portfolio of properties as a big legacy media company allows you to really lean into the strengths of that specific media property. However, there are a ton of advantages for being digital. Probably the principal one is that there's no legacy thinking. There's no, you know, this is the way things were always done. And that governs both internal debates and also the production externally that a consumer sees. And the best example of this is you look at our stream of top stories and our format of telling you why it matters. It's very, very focused on 2018 mobile consumption habits for that key decision maker audience that we're trying to cultivate. There was never a debate of whether we should do that. And I think there would have been if we weren't starting from scratch. The second thing is almost in this lean startup mentality, we're forced to focus on this kind of niche core audience relentlessly. And what that creates is it creates products that are completely driven to that decision maker cohort. And helping them unpack why things matter on their on-the-go lifestyle in the verticals that are really important to them. And it creates this hyper-engaged group of people because everything we do here, whether it's the sales, the marketing, the editorial, or the product, are all devoted to them. And lastly, don't underestimate the importance in brand building of a new, fresh face. Mm. You know, you take, not to single out Fox News, but the primetime median viewer there is around 7 years old. It's really hard to create a cool, new, innovative brand when your core audience is what it is for some of these legacy media companies.
Right, around news, which is not necessarily the most trending topic or the coolest topic for millennials. But I want to ask you, picking up on some of the things you said about having no legacy thinking and your target audience being decision makers, and being a network and kind of having, I guess, some of that baggage or an expectation as to who your audience is. And I'm thinking particularly in terms of Fox and MSNBC, who are right and left wing respectively, mm-hmm. that kind of shapes their content. So I wanted to ask about the political leaning of Axios. Are you trying to stay moderate? Because what I read is that it's quite moderate or centrist. Do you discuss that in terms of your reporting?
Yeah, so maybe to just shift the framing of that slightly, what we really want to do is we want to tell people the most important stories to them in that day, week, or whatever, and why it should matter to them. And you know, you can look at that and say, oh, by nature, that's going to be more moderate. But we think much less in that traditional political bias continuum, and much more, why does this story matter to this group of people that have subscribed to our newsletter or are visiting our site? And how can we pull the key insights out to them as soon as possible? And just one more point to elaborate because it's timely. Pew just released a survey, and it was showing that almost 70% of Americans are facing some kind of news fatigue. Mm-hmm. And that's 71% of conservative leaning and 61%, I think, of liberal leaning. So it's across the board. And I think what has happened partly is that old school framing of bias is leading to a lot of that fatigue in today's climate. So kind of completely escaping that and focusing on what I was just discussing is really important to us.
Yeah, and picking up on that idea of framing and framing as a new kind of startup news publisher, I've been reading Axios for some time. My mom even reads it, who's probably outside of the target demo, but there's a clear focus on what Axios calls smart brevity.
Yeah.
And in terms of that's a way of presenting content using bullet points and short form articles. Is that a calculated choice to fit the current media environment?
It absolutely is. Listen, we could probably spend the rest of the podcast going through other media sources and pulling out articles that we won't make it to the end of.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that there should only be 350-word articles. There's a lot of great reporting that gets done in longer-form journalism. But at the core, many of those articles are borrowing from a legacy medium, which is, I think, print. And if you look at a video for a comparison, the type of video that worked on linear and that worked in cinemas is not the type that ported over to the new technologies like YouTube or other mobile video formats. And so what I would ask is why haven't words, the content, actually ported over to match the interfaces where people consume? So it's not that it shouldn't exist, long form or longer articles shouldn't exist at all. But it's that there's this hole that has been created in the content side by this technological innovation. And we're really aiming to fill that. And just a little anecdote, Jim, Roy, and Mike, when they were founding this in between Politico and Axios, went to every advertiser, marketer, C-suite that they could possibly bring up out of their very extensive Rolodexes. And this idea that I don't have time and I can't curate everything myself came up almost unanimously. Mm-hmm. And so it's very targeted to that audience that they're trying to cultivate.
Yeah, and there's only so much you can scroll with your thumb. these phones keep getting bigger as well. So you talked a little bit about fatigue. What are some of the other kind of structural trends that you see in terms of how users are consuming news given the rise of platforms and mobile and tech and all the things we've been talking about?
Yeah. I think one of our industry's cardinal sins is equating this idea of active consumption with passive consumption. And you know, you can see that with the number of our peers boasting about hundreds of millions and billions. And it's almost like metrics don't mean anything anymore. And you can set aside the fact that some of these metrics are a three-second view that autoplays. I won't name names.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you set that aside, the idea that you're going to come from a low intent news viewing environment where you're waiting for the subway or in the parking lot with your phone and then be brought on to a news site and actively engage is false to me. I think the type of user we want to really get to is those users that have high intent and want to be active news consumers. And we're going to use the platforms that are a mix of passive and active consumers. But what we are really, really focused on, and you see it in our KPIs, is how many active viewers do we have? So we're, of course, going to measure traditional media metrics like unique visitors. But we're also really, really concerned at the product and editorial and audience level about things like sessions per user and things like page views per session. So once people get here, of course, we want a lot of people to come. I think it's content worthy of a lot of people's time. But once they're here, do they come back? Do we provide the value that we promised we would? And do they keep reading? Is one article so good that they want to read into the stream further? And so we look at our success as a kind of portfolio of those metrics and not just billions of views.
Right, right. And one of the interesting things for me is that this content is free. So you can come back and it'll continue being free. And so I want to ask about how your revenue model is. So there's a lot of discussion about publishers in the digital age struggling to make revenue. Some are benefiting New York Times, for example, but others are really kind of small and medium size organizations are really struggling. And, you know, I think a lot of people, they think that, okay, how do publishers make money? They put ads on their site. Mm-hmm. And I know it's more complicated than that. But I was reading that Axios does not use banner ads, pop-up ads, or clickbait titles, but instead focuses on native advertising. So can you describe for us kind of what that business model is and how Axios kind of made that decision?
Yeah, so you know, I would have traditionally said that advertising is almost impossible to do when you're trying to align user and revenue incentives. But I think Axios, better than anyone I've seen, has threaded that needle. And the reason is because our ads are integrated within our stream products. So that can be the newsletter, the site. In the future, it might be an app or other products to be launched. But if you go through our stream, you're reading card after card, and you'll see an ad in there. And that ad is, while it's well labeled, very native to the stream. It is very informative, actually. And so you're getting the right audience, but also in the right frame of mind. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone uses Facebook, but that doesn't mean that many of our advertisers want to advertise on Facebook, because the frame of mind and the psychographic approach that your user has when they're on Facebook is very, very different than when they're reading Axios. There's an active intent to learn about that collision of technology, business, and politics. And so that's one reason. The other reason is that we're not really trying to get click through to some other site. Just like our stories, you don't click through to another story. Everything is right there for you. And that's the beauty of the format. Mm-hmm. So people can consume the ad, understand it, and they don't have to leave the page ever. So it's very native. And you know, if you look at how we place our ads, if you click on an article, bounce right away, and never come back, you're not even going to see an ad, because there's no ad in the first viewport of our site.
Right.
And so creating things like clickbait titles to get people to a page that then has three ads in that first viewport is not possible for us, right? So the incentives are much better aligned than a typical display ad-based site, where you're incentivized to use clickbait titles to attract users. So it's not that we're all high and mighty with it, it's that we're incentivized not to. So I really think our ads, which is very rare in this industry, align with our user incentives in this case. And you know, we're always discussing new and innovative business models. Jim, our CEO, has been on record numerous times talking about all kinds of subscriptions. I don't have any news to break on this podcast, but he's been publicly quoted as one example, and there's plenty others.
Yeah, it's interesting. I never thought about what state of mind you're in while on Facebook. If you're scrolling through waiting for the metro, you're probably not looking to buy something. So there's a sort of disconnect there. Whereas I think if you're reading a newsletter about news, it shows, A, you're interested in being informed, and you're interested in being informed about services that you might care about.
Yeah, and to put data behind that, you can see with metrics like carts per visit, people that come directly to our site are, of course, more engaged than anyone else. But then you look at people that, it's almost an intent tier or intent ladder, people that come from other reputable news sources that link to us. So they're already in that very active news intent mindset. We'll consume almost as many as people that come directly. And then one tier down, people that are Googling questions or they're searching for specific information mm-hmm. will view maybe not as much as those direct visitors, but a good amount. And then you look at social feeds where it's a very low intent kind of boredom behavior, and that's the lowest value user to us. And so I think that gets back to the fact that many of our peers in this industry at large has been equating that lowest rung of the ladder with the highest rung of the ladder, one-to-one. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that's right.
Yeah, which leads very well into my next question, which is about the organizational structure of Axios, where I suppose it's anchored in the website. And as you said, those are the most engaged who come to visit the homepage. But I mean, it's clear that the content is designed to be social media friendly. So could you discuss the role of social media as it pertains to the overall organization?
Definitely. Look, I will not deny the massive scale distribution and targeting capabilities that the major social media companies have today. And we certainly do not ignore them. We kind of view them as this incredibly large top end of the marketing funnel. So both from an organic and a paid perspective, can we go out there, find audiences that want our content, bring them to the site, and then ensure that they're creating a habit? And so the newsletter is the perfect product to create a habit. If you think about appointment-based viewing, the 6 o'clock news, et cetera, we have a product that comes out, Axios AM, for example, at around 6 a.m. or whenever Mike wakes up in the morning. delivering the same value proposition each day in your inbox in bold. And so if you can get the right people off of these marketing funnels to that habit building product, you're creating a network effect within your little community. Mm. And those tools are really, really positive for that. But we are definitely not sitting here with the strategy of, boy, I hope these social media companies find a revenue model that works for news, and we'll beta test all of their platforms until they do. I just think we've seen how that works, and we're not willing to take a flyer again on that specific experiment. It gets into a little bit of a, I don't know if you read Ben Thompson's Stratechery, but he talked a lot about, he used Microsoft and Facebook or Google as two examples to contrast. But the key difference and what made one a platform and one made one not really a platform is Microsoft let the companies built on top of them control the monetary relationship. And you had Adobe and all of these other billion-dollar companies built on top of Microsoft, whereas you look at a Facebook and you had gaming for a second, you had news for a second, but by and large, there's been more destruction of value, one level above or below, depending on how you're looking at it, that platform. And I think a big part of it is Facebook's control of the revenue relationship.
Mm-hmm. Which I want to ask you about in a second, but I do want to pick up on a few things from the newsletter just because I've promoted it so much on the podcast. And I think it's interesting, this habit forming. So I think one of my personal habits with it is that I will make sure I have it downloaded before I get on a plane between that time for taxiing. So that's my own. It has become sort of habit forming. But how does Mike do it in terms of every day? Is that like his sort of number one job? Or, I mean, he's also running this company, right?
So he is a machine. And I often receive emails before the sun is up in the summer from the three founders. They are complete machines. And I don't know exactly how they personally do it. Mm. But we do have pretty solid infrastructure built around each of our personalities, whether that's Sarah with Media Trends or Dan with Parata, or the handful of other extremely talented reporters we have. And so it's not a one-person job, but we really do believe in putting those personalities forward and having that personality be the connection, the intimate connection that the audience has with Axios. And you can see that in our newsletters, but also the events, which almost always feature an Axios personality, and many of the other things we do. We have pictures of all of them very visible on our site, and we're always looking for more ways to put our personalities first, because that's really where the talent lies.
Yeah, it's super interesting for me to hear all these nuances that I hadn't thought about, but you can easily see it by reading the content. So going back to this idea of Facebook control or platform control over publishing, there's been a lot of discussion recently about the dominance of platforms influencing content and the distribution of news. With Facebook and Google kind of really, you know, there's been talk about whether they're a monopoly. They have 75% of the digital advertising market, and it seems to be increasing every year. So first, do you think this is a positive or negative development? There's some that argue that, you know, it allows news publishers to reach a broader audience. And then there's others who say, you know, it's a monopoly. Are these platforms too powerful in shaping content?
I'd love to meet the people in news who think it's a positive development in 2018. That's an interesting perspective. I think I was having a debate. So I was I follow a lot of like far right and far left accounts, because I'm very interested in seeing what those communities are consuming. And I got in on this Sunday, very fun weekend activity, into the comments of a very far right blog or site. And I was just wondering, oh my God, how is this allowed in a public forum? Facebook is, they need to regulate it. They need to get it out of here. Mm-hmm. And then in the same day, because I spend my entire Sunday perusing social media, I saw this incredible expose from a, you could call it far left or progressive outlet, that if you had looked 20 years ago, there are legal laws against this group of people. And so you can imagine an LGBTQ group, for example, falling into this category. And who's to say that Mark Zuckerberg in this case, but any other leader or C-suite would find that view palatable or close enough to the center to accept on their platform. And so I think the idea of Facebook controlling the dialogue is extremely dangerous. And what does that leave you with? That leaves you with, okay, well, there should be free speech and there should be this platform where anything can go to an extent, but maybe we should just have a platform where we can kind of control the outcomes. Mm-hmm. And you can, another analogy, you can look at the government. The government has all kinds of rights to collect all kinds of data. It's insanely private, but luckily we have a system of checks and balances that prevents them from using it in a way that we don't feel right as a society. And I think that last part is what's missing right now in our social media ecosystem.
Yeah, who is the check on Facebook? They just buy them out, right?
Right.
What about your interactions with these companies? Are you working with Facebook, Google to try to figure out how to better reach your core audience?
We definitely are. Mm. There are a ton of extremely talented and well-intentioned people there who have actually done massive positive things for the news, information, and media ecosystem. And that shouldn't be lost. We're in contact with all of them. And we're trying to find ways in which we can play with those platforms, whether that's Google Newsstand or things like AMP or a variety of other tools that they've produced in the last couple of years. And really what we would like to see is two things. We'd like to see audience or users who are interested in forming a deep relationship with Axios once they've had a taste have a essentially frictionless way to do that. And two, we'd really love to see environments in which publisher brands aren't completely commoditized to an article by article level. Because I think that then leads you down this dangerous slippery slope of, well, if this article is next to that article from a different publisher and we don't control the monetary relationship, then what's the difference between A and B? Mm-hmm. And you're then fighting a commoditized battle, which would be okay if there was a revenue model to support both of those A and B in the long term, but because there isn't, there's this serious moral hazard that neither A nor B will exist. Mm-hmm. And by the time they don't exist, it'll be too late to fix it.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that could be solved, I guess, with some sort of subscription service. Is that what you mean, where there's a kind of pressure to kind of go by an article by article basis?
It could be fixed by subscription businesses and from the New York Times at the large end or the Information at the more niche end. There have been people that are, I think, proving that it can work. The math on subscriptions, when you just boil it down to pure profit and loss, is harder to support a kind of big media infrastructure than I think the current fad of subscriptions has made it seem today. So like I said, we're not kind of just going to jump into a consumer subscription head first at the moment. Mm-hmm. But I think that is one of several ways in which you can develop brand equity.
And to follow up on this idea of working with platforms, are you doing any sort of advertising on the platforms in order to recruit new subscribers to the newsletter?
Yeah, we totally are. And I almost view our content, our stories that we put on those platforms, they serve two purposes. They inform, they're extremely informative, and they're also content marketing. They show people what we are and why we should exist, and they allow people to form and develop a relationship with us. But in addition to that, we do paid marketing to show off specific marquee projects and things we believe people should see.
Because there's been this kind of recent controversy around what is a political ad?
Yeah.
And you know, Facebook kind of grouping publishers who've been promoting ads about politics as labeling them as a political ads. Have you guys been affected by that at all?
We have. Listen, I think it was well-intentioned, but I don't know if it was I don't want to misattribute this, but it was a large media CEO at the Open Markets Forum yesterday compared pornography to articles covering pornography as the same analogy to what's going on with that specific initiative. I'm very much for transparency in political advertising, but I don't think grouping people covering politics who have 100-year legacies, for example, like the New York Times, or even 1-year legacies like Axios, into that category.
Yeah, it's just a curious, I've asked a couple guests on the podcast about, you know, what is a political ad versus not a political ad. It's just in gray zones. So I like to get people's perspectives on it. But we've been talking about publishing strategy, shaping content, and that's, I guess, most geared towards improving user experience on the front end, mm-hmm. right, in terms of reading the news. So I want to talk a little bit about the back end in your role in audience development and insights. And I'm interested into how development is measured. Is that simply number of users, nuanced things like time on the site? You kind of alluded to a mm-hmm. few of them, but how do you measure development?
Yeah. Like I was saying a little bit earlier, we're at least part media company. I think we're a media company. So we can't completely ignore traditional metrics, nor should we. There is something to be said about having scale. If your content is resonating with a group of X size and 99% of that group is reading your site, that is amazing. However, we don't stop there. We really want to differentiate between high intent, loyal audience and large numbers. Mm-hmm. And that's why we look at scale, engagement, and loyalty, which is kind of what I was alluding to with unique visitors as scale, cards per visit as engagement, and visits per month as loyalty. Mm-hmm. And if you can get all of those numbers trending in the right direction at once, you have this incredibly powerful, loyal audience that will really follow you anywhere as long as you're continuing to uphold that promise. And so that's kind of how we look at it from a metrics perspective. I will add one thing I've read a lot about is there's this idea of this kind of golden metric or this one metric to rule them all, which I think amounts to just smashing a bunch of metrics together with weights. Mm-hmm. We don't do that here. And the reason we don't is because, one, it's really hard to communicate what that means with a 100 and so person organization across various disciplines like tech, revenue, editorial, et cetera. And two, it really masks what's going well and what's not. I really want to know, is our unique visitor count going up, but our carts per visit going down? And then dig into, well, what are the reasons for that? And how can we solve that without having some other externality that happens that we haven't seen? And so having a small handful of metrics, or I've even heard metrics come in couples, having a couple of metrics mm-hmm. That might move in alternate directions and looking at them at the same time is a really powerful way to do metrics.
Yeah, I can imagine this sort of one metric would be almost, I guess, like a formula or an algorithm.
Yeah.
And it's hard to disentangle what part of it is going up or down or what's causing that kind of root issue or success on the other side. Whereas I guess if you break it down, it's also just more interpretable, I think. It's easier to see where it simplifies things, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Even though I know it's not, I know it's not simple. So I was looking at LinkedIn and I saw that your previous history is a financial analyst.
Yeah.
That's where you're coming from. So I mean, do those skills translate well when looking at audience insights?
Yeah, so I spent 4 or 5 years in investment banking and private equity, and my previous employers will hate to hear that from day one of my internship, I knew I was leaving before 5 years. I had this whole plan, and I didn't know exactly where it would go, but it kind of worked out well. You know, most young analysts, including myself, spend most of those years just complaining about the hard work. But having some retrospect now, I think I would definitely recommend it to anyone. You learn the kind of hard skills, like how to think about a business from a corporate finance perspective, which is kind of this menu into any part of the business. Mm-hmm. You learn the soft skills, how to deal with pretty difficult people under high stress with very few hours of sleep. And so that combination, if you can apply that to virtually any discipline and that kind of curiosity of looking at things from a corporate finance perspective, it'll take you pretty far. So while I spent most of the time while I was doing it somewhat miserable, I definitely recommend that misery on future college graduates. but I would implore everyone to, once you've done that program, really get your kind of intellectual curiosity hat on and figure out, what am I good at? What am I interested in? And apply those skills somewhere else, because it's very, very easy with the money and the lifestyle and et cetera to kind of get stuck on that path that's so well defined.
Mm-hmm. And so if you're on, if you're looking at analyzing private equities, I mean, I'm just imagining, you know, charts going mm-hmm. up and down. I mean, is that kind of a similar logic that you're applying to these different metrics, scale, engagement, loyalty? Are you monitoring those in a sort of similar way?
Definitely. There's still a lot of spreadsheets in my life, although I think I've gotten slightly more sophisticated by, you know, using things like SQL and other business intelligence tools and relying on smarter data analysts than myself to use the new age tools like Python and machine learning. Mm-hmm. But the framework, the mental framework is very similar. One thing that's different is I amaze myself with how little I knew about the actual core businesses that I was analyzing and recommending when I was in private equity versus kind of being an operator now. So that's a key area of learning, I think, that I've really undergone over the last several years.
Interesting. And keeping in this idea of metrics and audiences, I'm just curious about the rollout of GDPR.
Yeah,
whether that's had
yeah.
any sort of effect, because I'm, you know, based in Denmark, but I'm reading Axios. I mean, are you treating my data any differently, or has that kind of affected your job or the company as a whole?
Yeah, so we kind of lucked out on that. We have a pretty small audience cohort in GDPR-affected countries, single-digit percentages. Mm-hmm. And because we don't do any of the programmatic or kind of ad tech targeting that I think was most caught up in this, we haven't had a huge issue. There's all kinds of things we kind of consider in terms of showing users different things when they are from those countries. But by and large, no real business impact. And our CTO, Matt, is pretty incredible at being on top of the ball on this. So even if there was, he solved it long before I heard about it. and I don't know, do you want to go into that law a little bit? Or
yeah, why not? Because, I mean, did you have sort of meetings preparing? I mean, there were so many emails flying around everyone's box, right? I don't remember actually getting one from...
Axios was not one of the dozen, or maybe more than a dozen, hey, we're changing our terms and conditions
exactly.
Emails that you got,
exactly.
which I liked.
Is it simply because the audience is not so much in Europe? Because it's focused, I guess, mostly on American politics.
Yeah. I mean, it's that and the fact that our business doesn't really require that level of collection of data.
Uh-huh.
Whereas, you know, if we had an ad network where we were targeting very, very specific cohorts with first, second, and third party data, which isn't really our pitch, we might have a bigger issue.
So last question for you, which is, I'm going to pull a quote from one of your recent Axios pieces where you argued that, quote, the news industry and platforms need to find new profitable ways in which high quality news and information can thrive, end quote. So I want to ask you about what kind of developments were you envisioning there, or perhaps what are some ways, because I think the Axios model is super interesting and it seems to be profitable. What kind of steps are you looking for in the future?
Sure. It's an interesting question given what we've talked about today. I think on one hand, there's a lot of responsibility on platforms, et cetera, to improve. And the problems there are very well defined, I think, at this point. That is not mutually exclusive with publishers also doing everything they can to sustain and grow their businesses. Like I said, hope is not a strategy. And so in terms of business models that publishers could think about or are thinking about, you mentioned one. The consumer subscription route is obviously a great one. Bloomberg in the subscription category with an enterprise subscription has mm-hmm. another incredible business model. There's several others, including Billionaire Funded, which some of our peers have. One thing we're really interested in is, and this has been experimented with, but I think we're trying to do it in a very different way, but you can call it a smart Twitter maybe. But what we're trying to do is gather a community of experts in really niche fields. So we're not trying to scale each individual campfire or network individually. And so we're launching with, you can think about things like Bitcoin or self-driving cars and things like that mm-hmm. as very niche communities. We're trying to gather experts around those so-called campfires and get them talking about the things that they're experts about. So we don't want it to turn into a bunch of experts just bashing politicians, which is kind of what you see on said other platforms.
Right.
And we want it to be a relatively closed community. So we don't then want everyone talking about everything. So not everyone's a pundit. We want experts in their communities talking about the things they have expertise in. And what we found from our research is that there's a real, real desire for that. And if we can build that platform and we can scale it to a variety of niche industries, we can build an incredibly captive audience and all the business models that go with it.
Would there. That be a type of just a dialogue between experts and people listening in or kind of engaging with those experts? Or how would it?
Yeah, you can think about it like a conference focused on a specific community or idea. And so we want to get people, you know, Elon or the Tesla announcement, for example, yesterday. I would love to hear what the CEO of Waymo and the CEO of Lyft and the CEO of Tesla have to say about that and what kind of macro headwinds are facing them. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to engage with them. If I was a VP of audience at one of those companies, I'd love to engage with them and at least see what they have to say. And so that kind of closed community where it's experts, leaders, decision makers, and extended kind of professionals, having a little bit of a safer space that's more focused to go and share thoughts, I think would be something really powerful. And we were talking about news fatigue. The Pew study didn't separate it by kind of decision maker or level at companies, but I would imagine that the people highest up at those companies have the highest level of that fatigue, given just how much they have to consume to just be functional in their jobs. So I think there's a huge audience, huge revenue, and huge kind of product opportunity in that space.
And a lot of political junkies like myself, yeah, who are very much enjoying what you're doing, and I've found it super interesting to kind of pick your brains a bit about how it all works. So Ramiz, thanks again for taking the time out. It's been great.
Thank you, Michael, and I hope that everyone that listens to this goes to Axios.com and subscribes to all of our handful of newsletters, as well as continues to listen to your podcast.
If they've been listening, they've been hit with plenty of advertisements. But yes, do go and subscribe.
Cool. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
I've just been speaking with Ramiz Tayz, Vice President of Audience Development and Insights at Axios. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Next time, I'm going to be speaking with Matt Compton. He is Director of Advocacy and Engagement at Blue State Digital. And we talk about what it's like to work for digital communication inside of the White House and some of these high-profile Democratic campaigns while looking ahead a bit to the 2018 congressional election. So subscribe to get that directly into your feed. And in the meantime, you can connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast. Check out the Facebook page, Social Media and Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Chapel Hill. See you next time.